If you have a Bible there by you, let me invite you to open to that passage that Holland just read for us. Book of Acts, chapter 17. In the book of Acts, there are three recorded sermons preached by Peter. There are also three recorded sermons preached by Paul. Out of those six sermons, this is probably the most famous of all. Paul's sermon preached on Mars Hill in the city of Athens. Paul had recently come to the part of the world that we call Europe today, crossed over from Asia to Europe, had gone to Philippi in northern Greece, had come on down through Greece, and had to be shuttled away for his own safety, and arrived in Athens ahead of the rest of his mission team. When he arrived in Athens, he walked into one of the great cities of the world. I remember years ago, my first time to go to London and to walk through that city with its monuments and its museums and realizing that this was easily seen to be one of the great empire cities of our current world. Paul must have felt much the same way as he walked into that city of Athens. What he saw was an Athens that was near its prime. Even today, it's a magnificent place to visit, filled with temples and sculptures. But Paul saw it not in a state of ruin, not the Acropolis that is just populated with all kinds of ruins, but temples and altars and shrines in all their Greek glory, with the crown jewel above them all, there on top of the Acropolis, the Parthenon. The Parthenon in Paul's day was only 400 years old. The colossal image of Athena within that pillared monument, holding her spear, rising above all else. This gigantic image of Athena, made of ivory and gold, with the golden spear tip visible, Ryder said, from 40 miles away. Athens was the most aesthetically magnificent and culturally sophisticated city within the Roman Empire. Paul saw what many a tourist of his day traveled to see, but it had a completely different impact on Paul. In chapter 17, verse 16, we read his response to all this magnificent architecture. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. That adjective, full of idols, that's used here is found nowhere else in Scripture. In fact, it occurs nowhere else in the Greek literature that's available to us. And so it's a little hard to translate. We know it has to do with idolatry, and the Greek prefix kata is used that means full of, and so it's usually translated full of idols in most versions today. But it can also equally carry the idea that it was a city that was smothered with idols, or it's a city that was a forest filled with idols, that kind of a picture. The Roman satirist Xenophon said that it was easier to find a god in Athens than it was to find a man. Another Roman writer who visited Athens wrote six volumes on the religious beliefs of the Athenians. Paul summed it up in six short words. The city was full of idols. And rather than being enthralled by all he saw, he was deeply distressed. He was troubled in spirit by what he saw in that city. A city giving homage to idols what rightfully belonged to the God of heaven. And so while he waited for the rest of his team to arrive there, he began to share the good news there in the city. He went, as his custom was, to the synagogue, and there he found Jews and God-fearing individuals, and he began to teach them. But he also went down to the agora, to the marketplace. If you visit Athens today, you'll see that agora completely excavated, and you can see the very places and walk among the pillars where Paul must have walked as he began to engage people in discussions and conversations. That was the way the Greek philosophers did. That was the way Socrates did. He would go and begin a discussion, and debates would ensue, and learning would take place. And so Paul takes up that Socratic method of teaching and begins to engage people there in the market. In chapter 17, beginning down in verse 17, it goes on to say, "So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there." A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Now, the Epicureans and Stoics were two old groups of philosophers in the city. They both had their origin probably 200 to 300 years previous. The Epicureans, that literally means the philosophers of the garden. They were founded by Epicurus, who died around 270 B.C., and they were the first century playboys of the ancient world. Their philosophy was eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. They believed that the gods of the Greek world were so remote, so far away, that they were totally uninvolved and uncaring about the human condition. So their approach was, let's just have fun as long as life lasts. Now the Stoics, and that literally means philosophers of the porch, and they lived under the they taught under the columns there. That group was founded by Zeno. He died in 265 B.C. And the Stoics were fatalists. They believed that there was nothing you could do to change your lot in life, so you just needed to bear up under whatever life gave you. They believed in submission and endurance to whatever lot your life happened to see. One group said, "Let's party." The other group said, "Let's just maintain a stiff upper lip as we go through life." Now, these philosophers provided Paul's opportunity to speak to another group within the city, and that group was called the Areopagus. This was a group of people who met in what used to be the equivalent of the Supreme Court of Athens, the city-state of Athens. This was a meeting place up on Mars Hill, up on the Acropolis, where the ancient Greek judicial court met. But under Roman rule, it no longer had that judicial authority, and it became a place where the elite of the day gathered to share their arguments. There's not really a clear parallel in our society to the Areopagus, this gathering of these elite individuals. The closest thing to it in our society might be a university think tank, where you have the intelligentsia who gather together to look at new ideas and debate and talk things over. And so Paul, through his discussion with these two groups of philosophers, was now afforded the opportunity to meet with the intelligentsia of Athens. And they met up in that august gathering place, the Areopagus, on top of the Acropolis. What an incredible opportunity he had. He was there in the city only a matter of days, and now God has opened a door of opportunity for him to share the gospel with the movers and the shakers of the city of Athens. Look in verse 19. It says, "Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, 'May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears.' and we want to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul's skill in addressing this group of elite Greeks remains one of the greatest examples of cross-cultural communication that has ever been recorded. He begins by a reference to what their city symbolized, the symbol of all these temples and altars and shrines to various gods. And at the same time, he uses this reference to pique their curiosity. Look what he does here in verse 22. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus, and he said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you." He started right where they were. And beginning with that entry point, Paul preached to them about a God who was not distant at all, as they presumed the gods to be, but a God who is as close to them as their very elbow. And he began to talk about the God that to them was unknown. What would you do if you had one shot, like Paul did, at standing before a group like that? What if you could stand before Congress and had the opportunity to share with them the good news about Jesus? How would you do that? What if you could stand before the Supreme Court and share with them your convictions about who Jesus is? How would you do that? What kind of lesson would you put together? It's amazing because the Apostle Paul lays down five truths about the God that none of them even knew. And he began in the same place that our Bible begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so Paul begins with that truth. And in verse 24, he says there, he talks about that God, "The God who made the world and everything in it." That was his beginning point. He introduces them to the God who created everything. Now, their view was completely contrary to what Paul was saying. Both the Epicureans and the Stoics believed very differently from that. The Epicureans believed that matter was eternal, that nothing had been created. And yet Paul introduces them to this concept that it all had a beginning. It all had an origin, and it was found in the God that to them was unknown. The Stoics believed that God was pantheistic. He was in everything. God was in the trees and in the rocks. And Paul says, no, that's not where God is. God is the one who made those things, but he's so much bigger than the creation that he brought about. So they had viewpoints that basically were that this world occurred by chance, much like modern views held today by many of an accidental universe. And so Paul goes against the flow, just as Christians today go against the flow and saying, God created this world and all that's in it. And then he goes on to say, not only did he create it, but he is involved in it. He is the Lord. He is the Master. He's the one who runs everything. Look what he says in the last part of verse 24. He says there, having talked about God being the Creator, the God who made the world and everything in it, is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. He says this God that created our world is the sustainer of all forms of life on the planet. The Hebrew writer would later speak of Jesus and say this, that Jesus was the one through whom God made the universe. and he sustains all things by his powerful word. A picture of the Godhead keeping everything in motion, everything running. God is the one who sends the rain and the one who sends the sunshine. He is the one who fills our lungs with breath, even when we're sleeping. He's the one who keeps our hearts beating, even though we're not conscious of that. He's the one who causes seeds to grow. He's intimately involved in the world that he has created. And then he explains, because of this, God is the one who houses us. We don't house him. We don't build temples for him to crawl into. God isn't that small. There's no structure on this earth that can house the God of the universe. And so he says, he doesn't dwell in temples made by our hands. He's the one who takes care of us. We don't take care of him. And so he turns everything upside down in this sermon. And he says, you've got it all wrong. But he's presenting it in such a way that many of them were being won over by what he said. God feeds us. We don't feed him. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hillsides. Is he going to come to us and ask for sustenance for himself? No. He takes care of us, not the other way around. And then his third point is that God is the ruler of all nations. Every nation on this earth is under his dominion. Look in verse 26. He says there, from one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. Have you ever wondered why you were born where you were born, if you were born right here in America? Have you ever wondered why? Have you ever wondered why you were born at this time in history instead of some other period or some future period in some other place? Well, it says here that God is the one who determined all of that. God set the times and the places for all nations. And the reason he says that he did it is contained there in verse 27. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from any of us. You know why you were born where you were and when you were? Because for you, that was the ideal time to help you find God. God did it so that we could be close to him, so that he could come after us and we could find him. That's the reason for all of this. God's not remote. He is intimately involved in the affairs of man. He is close to all of us and he wants to be found. He seeks for us in the hope that we, in turn, will seek him. He loves us first so that we, in turn, will love him. And then he explains to this group gathered here in Athens that God is the Father of all mankind. Look what he says in the last part of verse 28. He says, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. He quotes the Stoic author, Aratus. The Greeks believed that they were superior to all other people. That Greek city-state that existed before Rome overthrew them, they had come to greatness in the classical age of Greece. And part of that greatness, they believed, was that the ancient Athenians, the ancient Greeks, actually sprang from the soil. They were almost magically brought into the existence of the world. And as such, they were superior to all other nations around them. And Paul here lays the death stroke to that notion. He says that we are all created from one person, Adam. We all are the offspring of God. And as such, he put the death knell in any supremacist movement. We're all one. We're all from Adam. We're all brothers and sisters. There's no nation that was created in some special way, different and apart and above all other nationalities. We are all one, offspring of God the Creator. And then he closes his sermon there in verse 30 and 31 by saying that God, by virtue of his creative power, his sustaining power, by virtue of his seeking us and wanting to be found, will one day be the judge of all. Look what he says in verse 30. He says there, in the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. God's going to judge this world. That's what Paul said to them. And he will do it in a just way. Everybody will be treated fairly. No one will get off. No one's going to get away with anything. God will bring about justice for every wrong that's ever been done. He's going to be just. The day has already been chosen. God knows on the calendar what day that's going to be, that judgment day. And the judge has already been chosen. And the judge is going to be none other than Jesus Christ. Jesus came into the world the first time to save the world. He'll come a second time to judge the world. And he talked about the resurrection. Now, he had to have talked about the death of Christ, or he wouldn't have talked about the resurrection of him. And so he begins in this sermon. We just have a very brief summary given to us by Luke, the author of the book of Acts. You can read through the whole sermon here in less than a minute, those few verses. But Paul must have argued and filled in all these points much more beautifully and much more fully than what we have just here in our text. We've got the Reader's Digest condensed version of what must have been a magnificent lesson that was presented there on the Areopagus. And he talked about all of these things. And he began with the God of creation, and he ends with the God of judgment. And in between, he talks about what God has done. He pictures God in his fullness in this sermon as the creator and the sustainer and the ruler and the father and the judge of this world. He covered in this one sermon the whole of nature and the whole of history, from creation to the consummation. Now, it's interesting that having arrived in Athens and having now been given this incredible opportunity and having done such a masterful job in one setting of presenting the whole of Bible history to these gathered in the Areopagus, that he saw the result that is recorded finally in verse 34. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them were Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. One of the think tank members was convinced. Some lady of significance, Damaris, was also convinced and responded in faith, and a few others. Isn't that amazing? Right there in the city of Athens, here is the nucleus of what would become the church that would grow in that place. You know, the message that Paul preached there is just as needed in our modern world. We have idols that are much more subtle than their gross approaches to gods. We have idols like music and sports and money and things and people and relationships. Anything that takes the place of God in our lives is an idol. And Paul could preach the same sermon here today, and I expect he would get about the same response in modern America that he got in ancient Athens. A few responded. This morning, as we close, there may be some here who need to respond to the God who created the God who sustains, the God who seeks us. He loves us so much. He wants to be so close to us that He came into this world in the form of Jesus, the divine inhabiting a human body, and He walked among us, and He died for us, and He showed us what the Father is like. And He did it so that He could take us one day to be back home with Him in heaven. If you're here this morning and you need to respond to the God of creation, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.